This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Since You Asked is a specialty show that includes articles and columns on advice, commentary, and opinion. This program is funded by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. Views expressed in this program are those of the authors or publications and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or its volunteer readers. My name is Alita, and I am your volunteer reader. Our first article today is from the July 11th, 2026 New York Times column, Ask the Ethicist. My aunt pretends my cousin doesn't have a drug problem. Do I have to play along? I am sick of the charade we are expected to maintain around them. For some time, I've known that my adult cousin struggles with drug addiction. But she and her parents lived several states away, and I rarely saw any of them. That changed about 3 years ago, when her parents, my aunt and uncle, bought a second home nearby and began appearing more regularly in my life. The problem is that her parents do not simply pretend nothing is wrong. They actively supply cover stories. The last time I saw my cousin, she looked like a zombie, hunched over with hollowed eyes. My aunt explained that she had been having trouble sleeping. I feel we're in an emperor's new clothes situation. My aunt gaslights the rest of the family about her daughter's condition, while my uncle meekly acquiesces. Making it worse is that my aunt is difficult herself, quick to air her political opinions or criticize other people. My frustration with her personality makes it harder to tolerate being lied to. Increasingly, I find myself avoiding these relatives, though that is difficult because they solicit family involvement. I am sick of the charade we are expected to maintain around them. At the same time, I do not feel it's my place to challenge my aunt's lies or confront my cousin about her addiction. When I imagine myself in their position, I know I would not want to discuss my child's drug addiction openly with relatives. How should I handle this? From the Ethicist. You've conducted a useful thought experiment by asking what you would want of your family if your own daughter had substance abuse problems. But you've come to the wrong conclusion. Indulging this pretense does nobody any good. Family discussions, while potentially embarrassing, can actually help people think through how to help someone who is struggling with addiction. As the NIH, National Institute on Drug Abuse, notes, addiction is treatable. But people don't seek treatment unless they first recognize that they have a problem requiring it. Your aunt's charade is pushing you towards putting real distance between yourself and her. If that's where you're headed, what's the risk in telling your aunt that you think it's pretty obvious that her daughter uses drugs and needs help? Unlike your policy of avoidance, speaking your mind at least stands a chance of improving the situation. Because drug addiction affects families, there are organizations, including Smart Recovery's Family and Friends Group and NARAnon, that help them share the challenges of dealing with loved ones who are in trouble. So if you're feeling family-minded, you could even offer to join a local meeting of such a group. People who've had similar experiences can assist others in thinking through how best to help. Even if your aunt's first response is denial and resentment, there's a possibility that she will come to see that there are better alternatives to her current see no evil strategy. And from the July 8th, 2026 New York Times, Social Cues by Philip Galanis. My sister asked to crash my dinner date with her daughter. Help! A reader who was looking forward to some one-on-one time with her niece created a headache for herself by mentioning the dinner plans to her sister, who was just as eager to tag along. My adult niece will soon be visiting Chicago, where I live. She suggested that we have dinner together while she is here. I mentioned this to my sister, my niece's mother, and she immediately proposed flying to Chicago, surprising her daughter at the restaurant and staying for a few days. But I never get to see my niece alone. So I explained to my sister that I wanted to have dinner with my niece by myself. I suggested other dates for her to visit, and I said I hope she understood. She didn't, but she agreed not to come. Our other sister has also expressed a desire to spend time alone with our niece, but her mother always reacts negatively. Was I wrong to refuse her visit? Signed, Aunt. When I was a boy, my mother told me that if I was invited to birthday parties, I shouldn't mention the invitations to other friends. They may not have been invited, and that could hurt their feelings. It's good advice, even for adults. And in a certain sense, it applies to your issue, though I certainly don't think you did anything wrong here. You seem to be well aware, however, of your sister's attachment to her daughter. She prizes the time with her and pursues it vigorously. If you had kept mum about the dinner date to which your sister was not invited, you might simply have enjoyed a nice meal with your niece. No need to quash any surprise visits or to explain the importance of time alone with her. Now, I know you didn't mention the dinner to hurt your sister. Who could predict that she would fly in for a single meal? But feelings of exclusion are not always rational. Your sister seems to want to see her daughter whenever possible, and boarding an airplane and crashing your dinner date are no impediment. Next time, follow my mother's advice and keep your plans to yourself. That way, there will probably be no visit requests to refuse. My husband and I have longtime friends with whom we often dine. We mostly enjoy their company. The problem? When we get together, the wife snaps at her husband. She gives him angry instructions and makes dismissive comments. The husband puts up with this to avoid creating a scene. It's uncomfortable for us. Should I speak to the wife privately? I'm afraid she won't take even a gentle conversation well. Signed, Friend. It's painful to witness snappish behavior and real-life enactments of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Still, it's hard to tell from your letter whether you have an independent relationship with the wife, which would make constructive criticism more natural, or if your interactions are limited to dinners for four. As you probably know, marriages are complicated, and outsiders rarely know what's going on or why. Your claim that the husband says nothing to avoid making a scene, for instance, is just your theory. You don't know what happens between them before you meet or after you leave. So if you speak to the wife, focus on what you do know, how her behavior affects you. When you snap at your husband, it makes us uncomfortable. Then the ball is in her court. Now, from the July 13th, 2026 Washington Post, Carolyn Hacks. Careless and carefree wife is never on time, even for big events. They've been married a long time, but letter writer is at a loss over wife's chronic tardiness. Dear Carolyn, my wife is never on time for any event, including our own children's weddings. I have tried everything possible, including going to events separately, but nothing has worked. She is extremely careless and carefree, has insecurities beyond comprehension. We have been married for a long time, but I am now at a loss as for what to do. Signed, Frustrated. Frustrated. Resignation. Acceptance. Those plus separate cars. I don't see what else there is, or what else you expect anyone to do, or who else you expect her to become, when it's clearly a life or marriage-long state of being. I can suggest a free education via browser on what makes people time blind. It is a real thing. There is a part of me that wants to say, enjoy your journey into the history of people who were written off as extremely careless and carefree before there were any formal diagnoses for neurodivergence like ADHD, but I'll stay in my lane. Plus, I can also list a few other things that contribute to chronic tardiness, like cultural norms, rank and consideration, passive aggression, or anxiety. Identifying the specific contributors to your wife's lateness is a subset of acceptance, anyway. That is, unless you and she have a co-epiphany and she starts adopting strategies of her own free will to manage time better. But even then, we're talking improvements, not miracles. There are attorney-managed solutions as well, of course, which she will be late for. But you don't need me to tell you those exist as an option. And presumably there's a reason you didn't divorce this problem a long time ago. So if you want to stay married, then I suggest you adopt a new definition of worked. Currently, you seem to define an approach to her tardiness as having worked if your wife shows up on time. Ergo, nothing has worked or ever will. Instead, you can choose to define something as having worked if it allows you to maintain a realistic and desirable quality of life under the given conditions. This, of course, means you will not be married to this wife in magically prompt form. Either you will be divorced and done with the loopy late show once and for all, or finally at peace with it on your terms. The latter demands that you anticipate her tardiness as a certainty. If it were real estate, we'd call it an incurable defect. That's when you just accept the house is on a busy street, and you had your good reasons for buying it anyway, instead of getting angry every time you hear trucks. Acceptance allows you to minimize, even zero out, the effects on your quality of life. There is no single fixed strategy for this. There is only the lateness itself is immutable. Therefore, what and how you plan must account for it, somehow. Leave without her. Lie about start times. Assign her a body woman. Find it charming. All the old tricks. Note, I am presenting this as a value-neutral quantity. If you want me to weigh in on the badness of the tardiness, then that's a different answer. It is also a non-answer because it depends 100% on the source. Or we skip it and you engage that attorney because you are no longer willing to tolerate it, whatever the reasons, and you're moving to a cul-de-sac. But if what you want to make is your life manageable with the wife you now have, with the time problem she has, then this is how to do it. Stop treating it as something you or she is ever going to fix and make a joyous project, even, of decorating around it. And a new Washington Post advice column, Say More. I was a high-achieving kid. Why am I flailing as an adult? Without the goalposts of childhood and young adulthood, life feels long and pointless. From the July 14, 2026 Washington Post by Mara Judkis. Dear Say More, I did the thing where I was a super competent child, young adult, and have now found myself in adulthood trying to figure out what it's all for. I feel like I'm the only reason my parents aren't divorced. Maybe a bad thing. I've never been in a romantic relationship. And while I love my job, it's not enough. I do also have friends and hobbies. For so long, I was focused on getting into college and getting a good job. Without those goalposts, I feel a bit lost. I had a brush with depression this past winter and am in therapy now. I keep saying I feel like I'm doing all the things, but it's a weird identity shift, deconstruction of going from the kid who planned it all to the adult who isn't really sure it's worth it. Is it just a matter of making new goals? Life feels long and pointless. Signed, was it worth it? Was it worth it? If we're lucky, life is long. And on some vast cosmic level, maybe it is pointless. But our life's work is to find meaning in it somehow. My sense from reading your letter is that you need a quest. You are a person who has excelled at making and achieving your goals, and now you've run out of goals. But a quest is different from a goal. A quest is a work of a lifetime. So, for now, your quest is to figure out what your quest is before the ennui swallows you whole. Is it healing your inner child from your parents' difficult marriage? Perfecting the art of doing or learning something just for the pleasure of it, with no inherent or intrinsic reward? As a former gifted kid myself, I know how hard that can be. Think of your emotional stability as being supported by a three-legged stool. One leg is your work, and that one seems strong and sturdy. Another leg could be categorized as self, and it's built of things that keep you going. Your physical health, are you exercising? Might help stave off the depression. Hobbies, finance, intellectual pursuits, self-care, in whatever shape that takes for you. But the third leg of the stool is your relationships, and that one seems to be the wobbliest. That leg is built from the people you have surrounded yourself with, your friends, family, and broader community, and the ways they make you feel most alive. How can you fortify it? Maybe that involves trying to wrap your head around all the stuff you picked up from your parents' relationship. Your therapist can help with that. Maybe it's gradually trying to make your own family, with a romantic partner, with friends as family, with some sort of community you can call your own, or a community that you serve. It doesn't necessarily require finding the one or relying on your family of origin. The beauty is that you get to decide what shape it takes. If all three legs aren't stable, the stool topples. Life is pointless and absurd and magical and cruel and edifying and jaw-droppingly beautiful, sometimes all in the same week. And the meaning you're able to construct from that swirl of chance and circumstance and self-determination is up to you. Serving others, finding love, making music or art, something else. Take your time to figure it out. It's not a college application. There are no deadlines, no acceptance or rejection letter, no honor roll. Just you on a quest to figure out your own personal version of the meaning of it all. It's worth it. You will make it worth it. And now, Miss Manners, from the July 10th, 2026 Washington Post, by Judith Martin, Nicholas Martin, and Jacobina Martin. When a dinner guest won't put the phone away, a host asks how to handle a house guest who ignores subtle signals at the table. Dear Miss Manners, I hosted a former colleague for a weekend. Like any proud grandmother, she wished to show me a video of her granddaughter singing, to which I happily consented. I was less pleased, however, when my house guest proceeded to scroll endlessly through her phone during our simple repast at the dinner table, searching for a specific video to show me. After being shown several videos, only to be told, "Oh, no, it's not that one," I gently suggested that it might be easier to search for and enjoy the correct video after we had finished our dinner. My guest assured me she would certainly find the video very shortly. I sat patiently through several other videos, which she showed me from her phone, propped up by a water glass. This woman comes from a politically prominent family and has traveled widely. She is often admired for her good taste. I was nonplussed that she did not catch the meaning of my gentle redirection. Is there a polite way to ask a house guest who is oblivious to a polite suggestion to cease and desist questionable table manners? Gentle reader, better judgment may vanish when one has become a grandparent. How else do you explain the gaudy toys and sugar binges that were strictly prohibited from one's own children? Grandparents cannot be expected to show polite restraint. All you can do in a situation such as yours is to repeat the request to finish the task later, making a show of putting your own phone away or saying that dinner is getting cold. But Miss Manners congratulates you on using the word nonplussed correctly. May you take comfort in that while you silently seethe at all the videos you were forced to watch. Dear Miss Manners, during several recent doctor visits, my quiet stay in the waiting room was disturbed by rude people dictating text messages out loud. The words were bad enough, but they also had to add the punctuation as they dictated. As a former English teacher, am I equally as rude by correcting their grammar in front of the other patients in the waiting room? Or are they fair game since they infringed on other people's airspace? Gentle reader, not equally rude, somehow even more so. As Miss Manners' gentle readers well know, one does not reciprocate with bad manners. And between talking too loudly and publicly correcting someone's grammar, the latter is the greater offense, no matter how good the syntax with which it is uttered. Dear Miss Manners, one of my neighbors, a semi-sweet lady, has a Pomeranian that barks at everything, and oftentimes at nothing at all. This neighbor invited me to pet her dog and was offended when I declined. What is a good way to let pet owners know that I am not a kindred spirit? Gentle reader, lest your neighbor deem you unsweetened, Miss Manners suggests you come up with a viable excuse. Perhaps, oh, thank you, but my hands are dirty, which all hands not freshly washed may be assumed to be. Note that saying, I just washed them so I'd better not, would not have the same effect. Dear Miss Manners, after several miscarriages, a friend is finally pregnant via IVF. While the couple is thrilled, they often find themselves in the presence of others who are having trouble conceiving or who have given up. Since they had their share of trouble, they certainly understand, but it's as if their mere presence is now resented. At a recent event where they made no mention of the baby, two other guests having trouble conceiving actually said this couple shouldn't have come with her belly. Do pregnant women and mothers with babies now have to hide lest they be seen as insensitive just by existing? My friend was even asked by family not to have a shower because of a relative who is having trouble getting pregnant. Gentle reader, this is one of the saddest letters Miss Manners has ever received. Not because of the difficulties of conceiving, which is tragic enough, but because of what it says about our relationships with one another. These are their friends, and they have been through the same struggles. But instead of rejoicing with them, others are shunning them. Is that how these people want to be treated if they were eventually successful? Must we consider life to be a zero-sum game where one person's happiness is a blight to others? If the still childless people cannot be happy that their friends were successful, can't they at least try to see it as hope that perseverance might be rewarded? Comparing oneself with others leads to a miserable life. One can always find someone who is richer, better looking, or more successful. You have only to go on social media to find countless examples of idealized lives that are driving teenagers and probably others to despair. Miss Manners understands sensitivity. She knows that there are times when people cannot cope with normal life going on around them. That is why there used to be secluded mourning periods for the bereaved. The solution is not to try to suppress normal life and begrudge others their good fortune. The way to think of others is with empathy. And that's it for today. You have been listening to articles and advice columns from our program, Since You Asked. This show is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Alita. I'll be with you again next week. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. Seabirds, like this short-tailed shearwater, spend most of their lives on the open ocean. These birds rarely encounter humans on the high seas, yet they are dying because of our marine debris. Billions of pounds of plastic end up in our global oceans every year. Animals that mistake this pollution for food often die from malnutrition, poisoning, or damage to their digestive systems. In 2025, a study led by researchers at the Ocean Conservancy found that a seabird who consumes just 23 little pieces of plastic, about the same volume as 3 sugar cubes, has a 90% chance of death. The findings also add to growing evidence that rubber is especially dangerous to seabirds. An earlier study of shearwaters and their relatives found that ingesting debris from rubber balloons is 32 times more deadly than hard plastic. We can all make the world a safer place for birds and people by keeping plastic out of our waterways. You can replace single-use plastics with reusable items, join a community cleanup day in your area, or maybe skip the party balloons at your next event. BirdNote has inspired millions of people to take action for birds. Learn more and join us at birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
There are more than 1 million English words. Next up, word nerd Steph Donoff with some of them worth talking about.
Yes, English is confusing. Take the words weather and weather. First, the noun. What's the weather today? Why, it's raining. Now take the verb, which is a contronym, a word that means the opposite of itself. Will my new umbrella weather survive the rainy weather, or will the rain weather it away, wear it away? Then there's the homonym, a totally different word that sounds the same. The weather is a conjunction used to introduce alternatives, whether or not we should go out in the rainy weather, for example. Well, here is a simple way to keep them all straight. Whether the weather be cold or whether the weather be hot, we'll weather the weather, whatever the weather, whether we like it or not.
That's enough talk about words. Let's go back to listening to them.
Oh. Audio Journal is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.